candles gleaming and painted candy canes on the tree. Santa's on his way and he's filled his sleigh with things and things and things.
This is April Grace, and you and I are listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, 93.7 FM in San Diego, and 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest and China Lake. Also streaming online at kpfk.org.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse coalition of feminists. And every week, we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. This week, we're rethinking Thanksgiving. Surge, the organization showing up for racial justice, is asking us to rethink Thanksgiving by being in solidarity with Indigenous resistance. And of course, Indigenous solidarity is an essential part of the struggle for racial justice. We know this nation was built on stolen land and broken treaties, and that Indigenous people today are still subjected to racial violence in the form of police brutality, dangerous pipelines, and disinvestment in community infrastructure. And we also know the high number of missing women and girls in Indigenous communities. So this season, Surge is inviting Indigenous solidarity, and they've got this great Rethinking Thanksgiving toolkit, which is being created by their Indigenous Solidarity Network. And we'll have that link up on our website. So this week, in our first segment, we bring up a piece from the archives about Idle No More. It was a grassroots movement that brought together environmental justice and Indigenous rights and was founded by four women in Canada in 2012. And it's still going in different forms and has inspired many other kinds of activism. Then after that, we take a listen to Popaganda, and it's all about the pumpkin spice. A few different perspectives, and hey, let's enjoy the pumpkin spice point of view. I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
When hundreds of people turned up to a teach-in called Idle No More in November 2012, the four organizers realized they had started something big. Within months, a movement for Indigenous sovereignty and environmental protections had spread across Canada.
We always come back to water and land because Indigenous sovereignty in Canada right now is the only thing preventing the Canadian state from fully accessing the land and the water.
Sylvia McAdam, one of the organizers of that first teach-in, tells the story of Idle No More, from round dance flash mobs to railroad blockades. A shopping mall in Saskatoon, Canada. It's winter, and the floor of the mall is crowded with hundreds of shoppers buying Christmas gifts. A group of people begin to drum. Soon, a huge circle is formed inside the shopping mall as people hold hands and dance together. Traditional round dances like this one, as well as demonstrations, teach-ins and blockades, swept across Canada in the winter of 2012. The movement became known as Idle No More, and began as a protest against new laws curtailing environmental protections, but quickly grew into a national and international movement for environmental justice and Indigenous rights. Chief Teresa Spence of the Attawapiskat underwent a 6-week hunger strike in support of the movement's demand for a nation-to-nation dialogue between First Nations and the Canadian government.
We're living in a third world, and this shouldn't be happening in this country. You know, they're getting rich by our land. Everybody's using our traditional land except us and all these mining companies and other forestries and other things that's been happening in our community. There's no benefit for us.
But at the very beginning, Idle No More was four women who resolved amongst themselves not to be silent about what they saw happening to their land and water. One of them was Sylvia McAdam.
My name is Sylvia McAdam. I'm from the Treaty 6 territory in what is now known as Canada. I'm from the Nihio people. In English, we're called the Cree people, but I am from the Nihio Nation. I'm one of the co-founders. There's four founders of Idle No More. Idle No More means protection of Indigenous sovereignty and protection of land and water. So that's our vision, is to keep pressuring leadership, not just in Canada, but also globally, that the protection of our lands and our waters is a very critical state. And the way that we're extracting resources in many of the Indigenous territories in Canada is detrimental to the land and to the water. And we're pushing and pressuring leadership to start moving towards using resources that are environmentally friendly. What brought me to that pivotal point was I went back to the land and the traditional lands of my people, and I realized from that point on there was activities happening that were so devastating to the land. In my mind, when I was growing up as a child, I was thinking of going back to those freshwater streams and those forests and those pristine berry-picking lands and the medicines that were growing there. And when I went back there last year, a lot of the land was devastated. And when I tried to go back to those lands where we had hunted and fished, I found out that those were being targeted for logging, and there was no forest, literally no forest. And then I went back to those freshwater streams that had been there before. They were gone. They were dried up, and that scared me into action, I think. And I was grieving and so sad that these things were gone. That brought me to that point where when Bill C-45 happened, I was like, no, I can't stay silent on this. We were actually going to call it Silent No More, but we thought, well, it was much more than that. It was being idle, so we said we were going to be idle no more.
It began as a small social media campaign armed with little more than a hashtag and a cause. But Canada's Idle No More has grown into a large Indigenous movement, with protests and ceremonial gatherings held almost daily.
In swirling snow late last month, they converged on Canada's Parliament in what became the largest gathering so far in the Idle No More movement. That began in early October with just four Aboriginal women and a Twitter hashtag, and it's grown into nationwide protests.
Well, in the early days, our first teach-in, we called it a teach-in because the four founders are primarily educators. On November 10th, we put it out into the communities that were having an information session on Bill C-45, and about 150 people showed up on our first teach-in, and then we shared our information.
Aboriginal and environmental activists are teaming up to resist what they say is the conservative Canadian government's attempts to appropriate resource-rich lands and to assimilate Aboriginal nations. They're calling
We're
on
not
Prime
here
Minister Stephen Harper
to sign a new funding deal or to make a small package agreement and new funding arrangements. That's not what we're here for. We recognize 140 years of colonial rule in our territory.
Well, when you think about it, the movement's really been in play for a long time, the use of our lands and resources without our consent. But the kind of spark was this legislative initiative by the Harper government, which started with Bill C-45, but also includes 14 other pieces of legislation that's being imposed on First Nations people without some of it, without their knowledge and consent. But Bill C-45 is unique in that it's a large omnibus bill, and it impacts both Canadians and First Nations in terms of protection.
What it is in a nutshell is it's an omnibus bill. An omnibus bill is a slew of bills under one document, and it's a 450-page omnibus bill that was introduced on December 18th, and it's unheard of in Canadian Parliament to have a bill move through so quickly and to become law on December 14th, and to affect the landscape of Indigenous people and Canadian citizens in a way that was far-reaching, and the effects are so devastating on so many levels. Not only does it affect the Navigable Waters Protection Act, it also amended the Indian Act in terms of the lands and the redesignation of Indian lands. And when you amend the Indian Act in terms of land and redesignation of a land, you're amending treaty. And this was done without the consultation or the input of Indigenous people that it directly impacts.
Introduce yourself.
My name is Audrey Redman, and I'm Dakota First Nations from Standing Buffalo, Saskatchewan. To me, it's a really exciting time because I think it's a time that First Nations are coming together, and we're coming around the same issues, which is the land. And right now, of course, with the bill C-45 that's going through, and they're trying to push it through. And I really don't believe that First Nations are going to accept any of it now. We may have looked like we've been very, very patient, and we are patient people, but there is a limit to patience. And, you know, there comes a point when we have to stand up and say, you know, it's enough.
When people started to realize the far-reaching effects of Bill C-45, it created a new consciousness. It created a protection towards land and water. And I think grassroots people started to realize the kind of connection that came out of, I don't know more, we became united. We became a united voice in protecting the land and the water. And for many, many grassroots people, when they began to realize, when they began to have more information about Bill C-45 and all those bills that were going through Parliament, they realized how terrible this bill is and what it's going to do. And I think Idle No More created, like I said, the space for them to tell the Canadian state that they don't have our consent to put this bill through. Idle No More gives space for grassroots voice in whatever manner that it chooses to be. Given that it's peaceful, it has to be peaceful, ethical, moral, respectful. You know, those are the boundaries that we ask. But if you can follow those boundaries and you have a voice as a grassroots person, then, you know, Idle No More is for you.
Now back to Sylvie McAdam, co-founder of Idle No More, the movement for Indigenous sovereignty and environmental protection.
We call it a grassroots movement, and it's not exclusively Indigenous because if you look at the founders, Sheila McLean is of European descent. She's not Indigenous at all, and Sheila brings in that element of allies and settler people who are in support of Indigenous sovereignty, getting non-Indigenous people to begin supporting those activities like Idle No More, to begin questioning the history that's being perpetuated out there, and then begin informing their own nations that what's happening is affecting all people. It's not just Indigenous people.
I'm on the line right now with Harsha Walia, who's a migrant justice organizer based in Vancouver.
Immigrants in Support of Idle No More is specifically to bring together people from racialized migrant communities who face, you know, a diverse amount of, who have a diverse range of struggle, particularly against racism and colonialism, from people's own homelands and histories, as well as ongoing racism within the Canadian state. And to kind of affirm that presence and allyship with Indigenous communities, and to do it from our specific positionality and social location. It's essentially a presence and asserting that there are many immigrant communities in support of Indigenous rights and Idle No More. I mean, one of the things that we have within the context and the discourse around Indigenous politics, and specifically Idle No More, is that they're, you know, Native and non-Natives, and the group of non-Natives is very large and diverse and has distinct histories and distinct realities.
Indigenous sovereignty is all about protection of land and water, and this is how come we're saying it's not exclusively Indigenous, because water affects everyone. We always come back to that. If we don't have clean water, if we don't have clean lands, then, you know, we can talk about nationhood and all these different things. All those are a privileged dialogue. But at the end of the day, if we don't protect our lands and our waters, those things become not as important.
First of all, I always say, before you do something, you need to make it known. So we're doing something now. We're acting. We're making the issue visible. And we're trying to make people relate between each other. I mean, non-Native are as touched by the C-45 than we are. So, I mean, it's just to show we are under the same problem. And now, how can we act together? And also, we are doing action like here we are, because people don't know there are still Native people sometimes in Canada. So now it's, what can I teach you? What can I exchange with you? And that's why it's been started by teach-ins, this movement from the four women that are in Saskatoon that created the IdleNoMore.ca movement. So we're going to try to continue. I'm going to try and teach people. They're going to try and teach me. I've learned a lot from other people during this movement. So I feel that it's not just going to be a fade. It's going to be something that's going to be more profound. I think in Quebec, mostly in the province of Quebec, it's already been proven that we don't want to be idle. Might we be Canadian, Quebecer, or Native? We don't want to be taken for granted no more. Students, French, Francophones, Quebecois, Native, Inu, Algonquin. So.
We've had flash mob round dances, and for people who don't know what a round dance is, I invite you to go into YouTube and Google Idle No More round dances, and you'll see a very dynamic visual of drumming and dancing and the round dance itself. As Indigenous people, when we talk about land and water, it's a powerful spiritual connection, and the round dance, it's been described as a prayer in motion. And when we round dance, we talk about, we dance on the land, we dance to the songs of the Creator, and it's all about that connection to land and water, and then that element of our ancestors dancing with us. And I think flash mobs are quick, and they create a unity, because when we dance, we hold hands, and anybody can join in. They're quick, they're spiritual, and they create a unity. I think that's how come they're so powerful.
Just to start, can you just introduce yourself?
My name is Charm Logan. I'm a Cree Métis living in Toronto, Ontario.
Okay, and you're one of the organizers of this flash mob here today?
Yeah, flash mob round dance. We wanted to keep it about unity. We want to make new friends with Canadian citizens and just start getting everybody together in solidarity so that we can understand the real environmental crisis we're facing in Canada.
Okay, so can you actually just tell me a little bit about what was this action about today?
Well, Harper government is pushing through some very dangerous legislation that affects our First Nations and Canadian citizens. It's going to impact our environment, particularly our water, and it's time that everybody wakes up and takes some action, and that time is now because there's not much time left. So we gathered everybody today to help bring some awareness to these issues. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the fact that these I Don't Know More actions have been happening all across the country, what does that say to you?
It has been a movement of resistance that's been going on for decades, for over 100 years, and it's just so empowering and spiritually moving to see all our people across Turtle Island and the world gathering to recognize that Mother Earth is the most important thing to us. We are from her. She needs care. So the fact that everybody's waking up and idling no more is beautiful, and to be a part of it is amazing.
And so can you just tell me a little bit about what you guys did today, what happened in this flash mob?
Well, it was supposed to be a flash mob. We had it planned out quite strategically, except there was way more people than we planned, so there was no discreet sneak up the way we intended it to be. And it just, as you can see if you were here, it completely took over the intersection and the square. So, I mean, we went from round dance to mosh pit because there was just so many people.
And finally, what are you hoping will come out of this movement, I Don't Know More, over the next days and weeks?
We need Harper and the Queen to deal with the treaties and the agreements that were put in place. We need the Constitution of Canada to be upheld.
People who haven't come out to the round dances, who have contacted us and said they're having letter writing campaigns and letter writing workshops where they've written to their MPs, they've written to the monarchy, and they've written to the Prime Minister and the Governor General, just letting them know you don't have our consent and all these different things.
I'm just seeing like the movement growing again, and Aboriginal peoples becoming more and more visible. I just wish there's going to be more, we're going to raise more awareness about the issues, and eventually that there's going to be a real dialogue with the government and the Aboriginal peoples, because we're going to continue our actions as long as there's no real dialogue.
We've had young people who, this was one of the very creative elements about I Don't Know More, where they've done, they did a little coffin, and they've written oppression, racism, Bill C-45 all over it, and then they wrote letters saying goodbye to all of them, and then they put the letter in the workshop, in that coffin, and then they carried that coffin and went and buried it. So that's the creativity of grassroots people. In the U.S., our relationship with the indigenous people has been strong. So we have I Don't Know More Minnesota. We have I Don't Know More Seattle. We've had I Don't Know More San Jose, California. And we've had I Don't Know More Arizona that we've been connected with. And now we have I Don't Know More Germany. We have I Don't Know More London, United Kingdom, and I Don't Know More Switzerland. So there's very strong ties, not just with the indigenous people, but settler allies from all over the world.
This I Don't Know More movement expanded to the U.S. border Saturday with a series of blockades and actions. Police closed the international bridge connecting Ontario with Michigan after hundreds of protesters marched from the U.S. to the Canadian side. Sit-ins and protests were also held at bridges, roads, rail lines, and other border crossings across Canada.
We decided that we were going to take peaceful, nonviolent, direct action. which means we're going to do blockades. Now, these blockades have to be strategic, prayerful, and thoughtful. We're not going to do blockades in the middle of, like, Denver. We want to target those blockades that have roads leading into lands that are directly impacted by activities of resource extraction. We're hoping that it'll create attention to the global community that these kinds of resource extractions are not acceptable. They're not good for the lands and the waters, and that leadership should begin moving towards alternative sources of energy. They're there. They're available. We have the technology, and we have certainly the resources to begin moving in that direction, and that the Canadian citizens, Indigenous people, all people from all walks of life, the grassroots people, are protesting these actions of resource extraction, these activities that are they're not acceptable. Figured out very quickly that the grassroots voice is in song, in dance, in poetry, in music. We had grassroots people come to us and say, I'm not a politician and I don't speak in that language. However, I'm a spoken word poet. Can I share a poem that I wrote about what these bills mean to me and how they affect me as a grassroots person? And then the four founders and I kind of thought about, we're like, well, it's unconventional and certainly not the way things would normally be done, right? So, but we looked at it and thought, okay, let's have a poem be said. And it grew from there. We had other people approach us and say, you know, again, I'm not a politician, but I know how to sing. Can I create a song for Idle No More? And we said, sure.
My skin red, I bleed red, I'm seeing red. I'm praying for my people out there who ain't seen it yet. His blood is cold, he's living lies forever told by his ancestors 500 years ago.
This one young man, his hip-hop name is Drezus, and he has a song called Red Winter, and it's in YouTube. He came to me and he said, again, he's like, you know, I'm not a good speaker. And he said, can I create a song? And I said, sure.
You can lock us in jail and throw away the key. Take away my rights, but you ain't stopping me. Cause I've been quiet for too long, it's time to speak. We gotta stand for something to keep us free. I'm out of no more. I'm out of no more. Yeah, I'm out of no more.
And all these different voices of the grassroots, and we made space for them to have that voice in Idle No More. And I think that's what gives it its power and its unified voice.
When the headlines are full of spin and the truth is hard to find, where do you turn? you turn to KPFK, because when our backs are against the wall, KPFK stands for the truth in media, not the BS. This Giving Tuesday, December 2nd, we're launching our fund drive with a goal, 500 new and sustaining members before the end of the year. We need you to join us. Become a sustainer for just $5 or $10 a month, whatever you can afford, and you can help ensure that the truth always has a voice here in Southern California. Stand with the truth. Become a member or renew your membership today by calling 818-985-5735, option 2, or pledge securely online at kpfk.org/donate.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK, 90.7 FM, and kpfk.org. And here we are in pumpkin season. We've just come out of Halloween. We're going into the pumpkin pie time. And it's all just part of this harvest season time of year. But why are we so obsessed with pumpkin spice? It's been so easy to hate on the drink and the people, usually women, who consume it. But the question is, how did this assortment of spices from the Indian subcontinent become the hallmark of, quote, basicness for white women? And what can the popularity tell us about capitalism, misogyny, and the need to belong? Well, Soleil Ho from Popaganda, which is a bitch media product, takes a light look, tells us a little bit about that with a bunch of guests. Take a listen.
At the end of the summer, when the super hot days get rarer, the signs of fall appear. Reddish leaves, leather jackets, people talking about football, and pumpkin spice lattes. Like death and taxes, the pumpkin spice latte seems inevitable, and it takes up an incredible amount of space in the public consciousness. So yes, we're succumbing to the siren song and devoting a whole episode to the PSL. So why are we so obsessed with pumpkin spice? And why is it so easy to hate on the drink and the people who consume it? How did this assortment of spices from the Indian subcontinent become the hallmark of basicness? And what can its autumnal popularity tell us about capitalism, misogyny, and the need to belong? To herald in this most sacred of seasons, I asked Amy Lamb to provide a squash-themed appetizer for you. You might know her from Bitch Media's other podcast, Back Talk. While you listen, I want you to imagine a crackling fireplace. The feeling of a soft wool sweater, the crunch of dead leaves, and the taste of cloves, nutmeg, ginger, and cinnamon. In our first segment, you'll hear from Tiffany Midge, a poet and humorist who wrote an open letter to white girls regarding pumpkin spice and cultural appropriation. After that, you'll get the specialty coffee barista's perspective from Adam Jackson Bay. Then you'll hear from Rebecca Jennings, a consumer reporter for Vox, who wrote about the backlash to pumpkin spice and what it all means. Finally, Sasanka Jinadasa chimes in to remind us of what we lose when we're so hyper-focused on the meaning behind a latte. I hope you enjoy the show. Tiffany Midge's open letter begins like this. Dear Kennedy, Madison, Scout, Brittany, Cassidy, Cheyenne, et al. Not to sound like I'm singling anyone out here, but as an Indigenous woman, I feel just a skoosh bit territorial, to put it mildly, about the commercial appropriation of pumpkin spice and how each year seems worse than the last. I don't mean to exaggerate, but each year the pumpkin spice season virtually impales me with dread as I wait for the pumpkin spice hysteria to lay siege upon my otherwise placid, pumpkin spice-free life. I don't intend to pumpkin spice shame anyone, but I'm talking to you, Piper, Elizabeth, and Clementine.
I'm always going to, you know, poke fun or indict, you know, whiteness or this concept of whiteness. And it's not so much the whiteness itself, it's just the cluelessness, whether that's willful ignorance or if that's just, you know, a characteristic of just kind of being able to live above, you know, what's really happening to other people around the world and oppression and things like that. I don't know, but it's definitely, for me, it's just punching up. And that's the delight of satire.
In her letter, which was originally published in McSweeney's, Pumpkin Spice Everything is a symbol of the ubiquity of Christian whiteness, a fact made ironic because of the pumpkin's indigenous origins.
Pumpkin Spice is, again, a representative or a symbol of that kind of proselytizing, that kind of message, those kinds of words. So to my mind, as an indigenous person, that makes perfect sense to me. It's like very symbolic. I think that a lot of times it's just the idea of, oh, hey, I never thought about that before. Because there's so many things that are just so explicit and obvious, you know, to certain groups that aren't at all, like nobody ever occurred to anyone, you know. And so mostly it's just education, you know, but doing it in a really fun way for me personally. I mean, it's fun. Some people get pretty upset, like they feel personally indicted. And I suppose that kind of relates back to the idea of me punching up. Like, I'm venting, right? I'm putting off steam by expressing these ideas, but expressing them in a humorous way so people can have that takeaway, you know, of a laugh or a humor, rather than just feeling like, you know, personally shamed, which isn't entirely my intention to just like shame people. It's mostly just to sort of, you know, jolt people into an understanding of what some of these things represent. We see it everywhere whenever we go to the market, and we're utterly saturated by it. And when it comes to the actual pumpkin spice lattes, and we always place the blame on, you know, white girls going to Starbucks and getting pumpkin spice. And that, of course, epitomizes, you know, the whole colonialism and appropriation and all of those sorts of studies. And it just seems like a pretty easy thing to poke fun at. It's not necessarily offensive to anyone. Well, it's just a coffee. It's just, you know, I've seen articles where pumpkin spice apparently isn't even in and of itself the spice. It's this other stuff that they put in it. That's like, you're not actually eating pumpkin when you order those things. Not pumpkin, it's just the spice that they use to like flavor pumpkin, which is sort of funny in a way too, right? Mm-hmm. That no one's actually like eating or drinking pumpkins.
An investigation by Heirloom Gardener magazine in 2012 revealed that, yes, the pumpkin that comes in those bright orange cans is, in fact, a squash. The pumpkin, in more cases than one, is purely symbolic.
Apples, peaches, pumpkin pie, who's not ready? Hot or high, let's all play hide and seek.
Adam Jackson Bay is a Washington, D.C.-based barista and member of the Barista Guild of America's Executive Council. He's a respected leader in the coffee industry. So I wanted to get his thoughts on how the PSL phenomenon has impacted coffee shops that aren't Starbucks. The contrast is especially clear because Adam is part of the specialty coffee world, which focuses on single-origin coffees roasted and brewed in highly specific ways that get the best flavor out of the beans. So a pumpkin spice latte, which emphasizes the syrup over the coffee, ain't that.
You do get the question about pumpkin spice a lot, and there's a lot of different ways, a lot of different shops have combated that, but I think for specialty coffee baristas specifically, like a lot of us is kind of grating. I won't say a lot of us look down on Starbucks, because I've actually found the opposite. I'm the only barista I know that's never been to Starbucks. It's just that it's a question that everybody expects to be the same because they've had this experience at Starbucks. So we've gotten this question, and it's a very interesting one to say the least.
So much of the job of being a specialty coffee barista lies in education, teaching patrons what constitutes a proper macchiato, or explaining what aromas might come from certain varieties of beans. For a lot of my barista friends, pulling people out of their comfort zone, say,
out of the cloyingly sweet pumpkin spice doldrums can be a challenge.
So it's like somebody who says they don't like beer, but they've only had Budweiser and Miller Lite. Not that Miller Lite and Budweiser aren't like great beers. I love both of those beers, but they aren't like the best example of what beer could be. So pumpkin spice customers or pumpkin spice people are people that drink coffee because they feel like they should be drinking coffee, not because they actually love coffee. And that's fine. And like, it's again about educating. And for a lot of specialty shops, like I can't think of a shop in DC that has pumpkin spice on the menu, a specialty shop off the top of my head. But in order to figure out what those people want, we need to come up with different ways to kind of bring those customers in.
Yeah. So what is sort of like the sort of like methadone equivalent to like pumpkin spice? Like what might feasibly be useful to like wean people off?
So I'm a competition barista. Like I've competed in the past two competition cycles. And part of that is a signature beverage.
Mm.
And like the SigBev is kind of what coffee's answer to, kind of like that methadone version of pumpkin spice. And the past 2 years I competed with a coffee from Papua New Guinea, two different coffees, both from Papua New Guinea. Like the tasting notes in the coffee are typically going to be savory. So like sweet potato, pumpkin, things of that nature, your winter gourds. And the first year I made an allspice cinnamon espresso soda. That's kind of what our answer is, that like you'll see shops like you'll see more sweet potato, especially like among like people that have a black barista specifically. We tend more towards sweet potato than pumpkin. You'll see more chai, apple, cider, different variations on hot chocolate. We did a chocolate chai for a while. You'll see different spice drinks in that way. So like it's just like getting those same elements of fall and getting those same like your apples, your like your warm, hearty spices. Those are the things that people are looking for. And those are the things that baristas tend to move more towards when you're talking about like making something for the fall. Like nobody is really going to try to put pumpkin spice on the menu or pumpkin pie on the menu necessarily, because like it's been done before. And like because we're such a young culture, we're trying to be as innovative as possible and just try to do things that nobody else has done before and try to give people a warm, comforting, reliable experience, but also something that's different than what they're used to.
It seems like from what you're saying too, and just like observations, that like pumpkin spice lattes and that whole like apparatus, mm-hmm, is very much a cultural marker.
Yes.
For some people.
Yes.
You know, it is just like, I am just a Starbucks person. Yeah. I am a pumpkin spice latte person.
Yeah.
And so you're not competing for those people.
Not necessarily. Like if they come in and we can make them something really great, but that's not really like, it's, mm-hmm, like they're different customers for every need. So like the pumpkin spice has become like a cultural signifier in that like the people that get pumpkin spice lattes, that's like kind of their thing. And that's what they're known for. And that's fine. You know, like, and it sounds way worse than it is, but like everybody has their thing. Like my thing is sandwiches. Like everybody has a thing that like people know them for.
The whole thing with pumpkin spice lattes is their uniformity. The one you're getting this year is the exact same as the one you got last year, and that's on purpose. As a species, we tend to mark the movement of time with rituals steeped in that sense of long-running sameness, like coming-of-age ceremonies, anniversaries, and that awful Christmas song by Paul McCartney. When we dip into those familiar movements, emotions, and sensations, we take comfort in knowing that this is something everyone else is doing. We can make sense of the overwhelming chaos of the universe. By remaining consistent, Starbucks has brilliantly positioned the PSL as just another definitive autumnal experience, essentially guaranteeing themselves a nice little income spike every fall. While that might seem intimidating for smaller coffee shop owners, Adam seemed pretty unbothered.
Pumpkin spice, like, at the end of the day, is safe. Like, you know exactly what you're going to get. And it's going to be great every... It's going to be good every time, but it won't be great. Like, you say, oh, that was really great latte, but... Mm. it's literally the exact same latte you got yesterday, because that's what Starbucks does consistently. But like specialty coffee, like it has the chance to really like change your mind about what you thought coffee was. And like that's why I'm still in it.
No, it reminds me of like eating a fresh tomato for the first time.
Yeah. You know?
Just like, oh, I get it.
Yeah, that's exactly what it's like. Eating fruit in season, like from a farmer's market. That's exactly what it's like.
I was really delighted to read Rebecca Jennings' piece on the pumpkin spice backlash on Vox, because it articulated a lot of my hesitation with the PSL hate, something that's become as much of a yearly tradition as the beverage itself. We've had the pumpkin spice latte for 15 years now, and it doesn't seem to be going away. The more interesting question about it, which she and other guests on the episode pose, is what are we actually talking about when we talk about pumpkin spice?
I was mostly interested in sort of digesting why we've had so many rounds of this discussion, why it never goes away, why like every September it's like, oh, pumpkin spice, like gotta talk about it. So what I basically was interested in, why it gets people so upset and why we keep talking about it. So what I started to notice was that people started to sort of make fun of the pumpkin spice latte drinker around the time that Instagram was, you know, happening. So like the early 2010s, and sort of what I think is like, when you see a trend happening on Instagram, like when you see a barrage of Instagrams that are like wearing Uggs and like, you know, in front of like a pile of fall leaves, and then there's a pumpkin spice latte in there, and it's like, it's super easy to make fun of, you know, if enough people are doing it, it's like, oh God, that becomes its own sort of stereotype. And there we got like this idea of who the pumpkin spice latte drinker is. It's someone who like unabashedly adores fall, who like gets real joy and nostalgia out of these like very dorky activities. Someone who wears these clothing items that we think of as basic, et cetera. It just sort of got wrapped up in this persona of who we think of as the pumpkin spice latte drinker. But on another note, I think pumpkin spice lattes often come out in a time of year that is not particularly autumnal. Like this year, they came out at the end of August. It was 90 degrees the first day they came out this year. And, you know, it just shoves the seasonal creep in your face. And I think seasonal creep is something that people have like capitalistic anxieties about anyway. And when it's so in your face as pumpkin has been, then it sort of like forces us to sort of reckon with that. A lot of people are sort of like, they cry agricultural revisionism because pumpkin spice is released in summer and, you know, pumpkins are more associated with the holidays and like later in the fall. And I think what that is sort of us sort of like warning each other about falling for marketing. You know, seasonal creep is not limited to pumpkin spice. That's sort of just the way that's what capitalism rewards. It rewards, you know, being the first to things. So we sort of get uncomfortable when we're like, we see that play out in such a drastic way as we do with pumpkin spice.
What does seasonal creep, like, why is it such a source of anxiety for us? You know, most of us aren't farmers. Like, why do we care about, you know, when autumnal squash actually exists in the world? Because most of us are really alienated from like the harvest calendar.
Yeah, exactly. Most of us are totally like, and that's why it feels kind of disingenuous when people are like, well, actually, like pumpkins aren't in season. And it's like the marketing feels so not in your face, but it's so exposed in a way that like marketing in general, it tends to be like more delicate and, it, you know, tries to pretend that it's not marketing. But when we see, you know, Christmas stuff in the pharmacy at, you know, in October or September, like, it's like, oh my God, we're living in a simulation or something.
It seems a little bit more insidious because so much of the pumpkin spice latte marketing is aimed towards women too. I feel like some of the backlash is like, oh, these stupid women, they don't even know when a pumpkin like exists, you know, like why are they buying pumpkin spice lattes?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because pumpkin spice is such like a feminine coded spice, I guess, or like food. We definitely see a lot of anti-pumpkin spice from men who, you know, think that they're sort of above this sort of marketing. Like they're above the idea that they could be marketed to by Starbucks. We don't tend to look down on men as much for, you know, falling for, say, barbecue or like IPAs, stuff like that.
Yeah, it seems like it's like the lie is that women are more susceptible to capitalism, but the truth is that we all are.
Oh, yeah.
Like we're all within this machine, right?
Yeah. Yeah, none of us have any control ever. Just kidding. But not.
Yeah, why is it so much easier for pumpkin spice to be that cipher for us, for like talking about or talking around capitalism and marketing and all of these things? Like, why can't we just say like capitalism's bad and, you know, maybe this is a symptom, but let's actually go for like the actual disease.
I mean, we could solve so many arguments if we just all just were like, capitalism is bad. That's always the answer. we joke about this at work all the time. Like I write about consumer culture and it's like, the answer is always the same. It's that capitalism is bad. But, you know, that can't be the last sentence of every article, unfortunately.
It's been really interesting, like watching, as you note in your piece, like just the automated backlash and just all the takes. There's just so many different takes on why it's bad, you know, and it's a very diverse like pool of opinions on why it's bad.
Yeah. I mean, you're allowed to think that pumpkin spice is bad. I just think there's probably a deeper meaning than what a lot of people say that they think is bad about it. You know what I mean?
What is the conclusion that you really wanted to land here?
So something that I found with what's happening now is that A, people don't really care anymore. There are so many other like fall flavors and there are also so many other things going on in the world, but that's also kind of like an easy, you know, answer. You could say that really about anything. But I also think that pumpkin spice isn't as prevalent as it used to be. And another thing I sort of have thought about in the past couple of weeks is that this idea of sort of building your personality off of something that you don't really like, or that you're sort of building your personality off of, like, I don't like basic girls who like pumpkin spice lattes. Like, that's sort of like not very cool anymore. And it's not very original. Like, I just feel like you don't see a lot of people centering their identities around being like, you know, this like hipster meanie. Yeah. And I think the mood right now is sort of like, let me like what I like. Like, if I get some joy out of this, whatever, let me live. And I think pumpkin spice in general now is really interesting, but I also think that it's not as much of a like a heated, super, you know, fraught topic as it maybe it was like 4 years ago or something.
I think a lot of things have changed since 4 years ago. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Sure have.
I think we're just like constantly a lot more tired these days. So why fight about pumpkin spice?
Exactly. And if you do, like, there are really good reasons to, but I think in general, like the general conversation is that, like, all right, I mean, we went through that. Like, let's move on.
Right. So what should we be focusing on instead? I asked Sasanka Jinadasa, a partner and consultant of the collective Reframe Health and Justice, for their opinion. They wrote an article for Black Girl Dangerous on all of the reasons why, as a radical queer person of color, they should be free to feel a little joy sometimes, even with something as, quote, white as pumpkin spice lattes.
I wrote that piece because I was thinking about the ways that people are always telling femmes, and particularly femmes of color, like how to dress, how to act, what to eat, what not to eat. And I was thinking about the way we do it in the social justice world, so to speak. And I couldn't get out of my mind that what we do often is take things that generally people love, like people generally love cinnamon or generally love things that taste good. And then we tell people that they're white or not white, and nothing basically belongs solely to white people, because so much of what is produced through the lens of whiteness has been colonized or taken or appropriated from people of color. So to me, the idea that anything that isn't about like capitalistic violence is a white thing is so silly to me. And the funny thing is, and my girlfriend thinks this is hilarious, is I don't even really like pumpkin spice lattes. I like pumpkin spice things like pumpkin bread and pumpkin cake and all of those wonderful things. I don't really like pumpkin spice lattes, but I do really love all the things that make up this flavor that's called pumpkin spice. And I grew up indulging in those flavors through like a very different form than people think about what pumpkin spice means.
Why do you think it's so easy for us to invest so much intellectual, psychic, emotional energy into the things we buy? And, you know, it is just one person and one thing that they're buying or consuming. And but we feel this burden of doing right in that act, even though, you know, the actual impact of doing so is really negligible. So can we talk about the things that you concluded the piece with? Because I thought that was really, really cool, is you actually lay out ideas for people to, rather than withholding themselves from the pumpkin spice apparatus, you give people options. Like, how do you exit from this like loop of moralizing and like angst and grief? And how do you actually build community in the way that you were talking about?
Allowing yourself to heal from toxicity. You know, I now have to negotiate every little interaction I have to make sure it is the most just possible. And when it comes to something that ultimately doesn't really matter at all, like be happy, have your latte. But also, you know, I made chai last week in my house and it was delicious and it was better than Starbucks chai and most people's chai, you know, that gets sold in stores. But if I reject the concept of pumpkin spice, right? Or chai, because people sell it who probably shouldn't sell it or probably shouldn't, you know, be making so much money off of it. I haven't gained anything by rejecting it entirely. I only gain if I like allow myself to like feel pleasure. One of the like original harm reduction like activists, like many of them call themselves pleasure activists. And I would love for us in the social justice world to be pleasure activists, to be folks who move towards like a happy society, not just one where everyone redistributed wealth, but like if we're not happy in that, if we aren't able to find like creativity and joy, literally what's the point, right? I think it, right, Emma Goldman has that saying about, you know, if I can't dance after a revolution, I don't want any part in it. A lot of people, you know, in like current trends, are talking about like luxury, automated, what is it, like gay space communism. And why not? Why not have like this like luxurious society where like everyone has access to like chaise lounges and beautiful things and like great tasting food that, you know, is like incredible and lush and desirous. And everyone should be able to access it, right? Like, let's not move towards austerity as our mode.
Thanks to Tiffany Midge, Adam Jackson-Bay, Rebecca Jennings, and Sasanka Jinadasa for speaking with me for this episode of Popaganda.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. And thanks to all of the contributors today, especially to Making Contact Radio. Feminist Magazine is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. Don't forget, you can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter and sharing behind-the-scenes photos on Instagram. Or just email us, oldschoolstyle, at feministmagazine@yahoo.com. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, too. And tune in for more from Feminist Magazine. Thanks for listening.
Mm-hmm. Many listeners make KPFK possible by giving what they can. Some donate monthly, others give once a year, and some give in a big way by donating land or real estate that they no longer need. That unused cabin, a vacant lot, or a home that's no longer in use, those properties can help ensure a future for your community radio station. Real estate donations can come with tax benefits for you and lasting value for KPFK. It's easy to start. Just visit kpfk.org/real estate or call 1-844-277-4663 and learn how your gift of property can make a meaningful difference.
La agencia ICE está intensificando las operaciones de deportación en el área de Los Ángeles. Pero si lo detienen agentes de la ICE, usted tiene derechos constitucionales sin importar su estatus migratorio. Si usted o alguien que conoce ha sido detenido o desea denunciar a la ICE, puede obtener más información en CHIRLA, llamando al 888-624-4752 para obtener ayuda legal y recursos. Es un servicio bilingüe. Para más información, visite chirla.org.
Hi, this is Robbie Krieger from The Doors, and you are listening